From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 13th day of September 2010, a Monday. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Kurt Kimmel. He's the senior grains analyst at Bates Commodities in Normal, Illinois. And then later in the half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with the folks at the Andersons right here in Champaign County. In agricultural news, China says it will treat foreign-owned businesses operating in the PRC the same as homegrown storefronts. Russia is closing in on a long-term trade goal to join the WTO. And the world's fourth largest wheat exporter expects to harvest its largest crop ever. Dave Dickey will have details of these stories later in the half hour. And then we'll recap how USDA NASS came to the conclusion Friday that the nation's largest ever corn crop will be worth more per bushel than any before it. Hey, don't forget, in just 26 minutes, we'll check in with the folks at Chesapeake Energy to discuss the global agricultural weather forecast right here on this edition of the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media.
The Closing Market Report is made possible in part by a grant from Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois, a full-service commodities firm with two toll-free lines. In Illinois, 800-252-2013. In Indiana, 800-637-3123. Or email to cooley at admworld.com.
In Chicago on this Monday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. The nearby contract in the wheat pit at 7.13¾, up 9 cents for the soft red. December at 7.45, up 8¼. Next year's July at 7.44, 2¼ higher. In Kansas City, at the Board of Trade there, the hard red at 7.57½ on the lead option, up 10¼ cents. September corn back at the CME Group in Chicago, 4.69¼. The settlement price up 5¼. December at 4.83½, at 5¼ higher. And the March at 4.96¾, 5½ cents higher. May futures, $4.99¾, up 5. July at 5.02¼, 5¼ lower. And then the red started to come with the September and the December, 4.56 on the D's, down 3¼ on its settlement price for the day. September soybeans up 1¾, $10.25¼. November at 10.34½, 3½ higher. January at 10.44, up 3¾. And July beans at 10.16¼, 4 cents higher. Meal at 2.96.80, down 40. Oil at 41.34, 9 higher for the day. October live cattle at 97.45, up 30. September feeders at 112.35, up 65. And October lean hogs today at $76.30, 95 cents lower. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from the U of I. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. October crude oil, $77.22. They're up 76 cents a barrel. Ethanol at $2.09, up 3¼. Natural gas at $3.93, 5¼ higher. And the heating oil today at $2.12¾, up 1¼ cents. Gold futures at $1,245.10 an ounce, 60 cents higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average at 10,520 is up 57 points for the day. The U.S. dollar at 81.91 is down 0.78 on the afternoon. Here's what the weather forecast it looks like at this hour. This afternoon should show some sunny skies, high near 85 degrees. North winds at around 10 miles an hour. Tonight, mostly clear, low of 53, north-northwest winds between 3 and 7 miles an hour. And tomorrow, mostly sunny skies, a high near 80, southeast winds between 3 and 7 miles per hour tomorrow. And then on Wednesday, partly sunny skies on Wednesday, with a high near 79, east winds between 6 and 8 miles an hour. Wednesday night, a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms, mostly cloudy then, a low around 58 degrees. And Thursday, a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms, mostly cloudy, a high near 75. Thursday, mostly cloudy, a low of 55. Friday, mostly sunny. The extended forecast says 76 degrees on Friday, 54 partly cloudy on Friday night. Saturday, mostly sunny, a high about 78. And Saturday, partly cloudy, a low of 58 degrees. We'll take a more complete look at the agricultural weather forecast when we get to the bottom of this half hour. We'll talk with the folks at Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois, right here on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report.
Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Bob Baisdiffer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
This is the Closing Market Report. It's a Monday afternoon. On the phone line with us, as usual, Kurt Kimmel of Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. Good afternoon to you, Kurt.
Good afternoon, Todd.
And, you're making your trip to Champaign this evening. You and Jackie Vakes from Stuart Peterson and Bill Gentry of Risk Management, along with Dave Dickey, will be at the Champaign County Corn and Soybean Marketing Club this evening. That kickoff time, I think, is at 7 o'clock, so you probably are thinking about what you're going to tell them tonight. Can you give us a preview?
Well, probably the main question will be is how high is high. We've got a dynamic market going in the on here, and the momentum's to the upside. There's enthusiasm out there on receiving much higher prices. In fact, almost over a dollar more than what we were looking at here last winter, last spring, and so there's a lot of optimism in there, but too, as we move higher here, there's also going to be risk to the downside. So look forward to covering some trading and marketing ideas in general on how to manage risk and how to trade the market and get in the game.
No, I think a little bit later in this program, we'll try to prime them for how high has high. USDA NASS on Friday said 440 for the average cash price. That's the highest ever cash price for corn. We'll hear from Daryl Gooden, and he'll talk a little bit about that. But then you'll have to take it up once you get to the marketplace there in Champaign County tonight. That starts at 7 again. It's at the County Farm Bureau building, which is on the west side of town. When you look at that 440 price and you think about what that means in the futures, there's got to be a pretty a number of days over $5, I would think.
We're going to have to move higher here and keep the average higher here as we go through the marketing year, because basically there's been grain sold at much lower levels than that. And you're correct. We're going to have to move higher here and stay up here. We kind of feel that 480 here over the near term is a benchmark to watch. We wouldn't be surprised to see the market sort of may consolidate here for a little bit, but upside targets as high as $6 are being touted there. I think that's a little longer term, but short term in here, we'll see how the market reacts here as we start to pick up some harvest pressure as we get more of this grain coming to town. Harvest pressure in general is not going to be huge because a lot of producers sold grain earlier, a lot of talk of some areas with lower yields. And so until producers get comfortable with their production prospects, it's going to be awful hard to see a huge amount of harvest pressure coming at us here in the near term, Todd.
You know, I did see, and this has been said quite a bit, a couple of things, but simply the headlines will say things like store corn sell beans. But when you look at the numbers, you're only talking about 15 cents to get yourself to what, March on corn? On 20 cents to get yourself to July, is that really worth it?
Well, it depends if you're looking on farm storage, off farm storage. You know, commercial storage is going to be kind of tough to pencil it on out. There is some carry in the market, but it is kind of thin. You know, guys are pushing the pencil on that. They say, you know, I can pick up this much, but it's going to cost me that much to store it. So it's a real challenge, and that's what we've been working on. You know, our brokers have been working with guys on different options, different strategies. You know, surprisingly, if you guys, you know, wanting to just get the stuff moved and re-own it on paper, if it keeps going higher, they're on board. If not, they got, you know, they know where the risk is on it. So there's some unique strategies out there, and I'm sure everyone's got a favorite one they're looking at.
Carryovers are pretty tight, really tight for corn. Not so the case in the soybean market. Yet beans were up a little bit again today.
Yeah, we saw a little short covering, a little bit of bean business taking place. Ideas are that China's been in the U.S. market. We're looking at anywhere from 3 to 5 cargoes being sold to China. Should show up here fairly quickly. And also, too, bean oil. A lot of bean oil starting to move now, and so the bean complex saw an update here on some renewed export demand to Asia.
And then when producers are calling you, and I know they are at this time, what are they telling you about both their bean yields and their corn yields, and can you see regional differences across the country very much yet?
Well, we're seeing good bean yields for the most part. Bean yields are above expectations. So as a whole here, we'll know more about the beans as we get through this week. Still a lot of green beans out there, but a lot of guys were getting into beans this week, so we'll see their future here. As we get towards the end of the week, I'm sure Mike will have a lot of yield reports by then. Corn, it just varies a ton. You know, earlier we were looking at corn on corn being disaster. 95, 97 bushels. Some has come up into this 150 bushel area. A lot of variance on ground. A lot of variance between 28% nitrogen and anhydrous ammonia application. It seems like it's in the central part here where the large diversity is taking place. But two, as we talk to guys in Iowa, central Iowa, they've got some wild yield variations in through there too. So we've heard it all. But here today, the main thing is we're hearing more over 200, some 220, some 230s out there. So it's not a complete disaster everywhere.
All right. Thanks so much.
Very good.
Mm-hmm. We'll see you tonight. That's Kirk Kimmel. He's with Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. He joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Monday afternoon.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
By the way, if you want to talk to Kurt, you can do that this evening. He'll be at the Champaign County Farm Bureau building along with Dave Dickey, our Director of Agricultural Programming. He'll be here, too, in a moment to take up the agricultural news. Jackie Vanks of Stewart Peterson will be on that panel, as will Bill Gentry of Risk Management Commodities. They'll be at the Champaign County Corn and Soybean Marketing Club at the County Farm Bureau building. On the west side of Champaign, Illinois, that starts at 7 o'clock this evening. If you're out of the field and you get a chance to come in and talk with them, you can ask questions if you'd like. It's all part of the service from willag.org. Again, Dave Dickey will be here in a moment to take you through the ag news. And if you do get the opportunity, visit our website. The address is willag.org.
In agricultural news, China Premier Wen Jiabao today says that foreign businesses in China will be given the same treatment as local companies. China has repeatedly said that it will not discriminate against foreign businesses, but global executives worry that new rules meant to support innovation in China could make it harder to win contracts in the fast-growing market. The European Union Chamber of Commerce in China said in its annual position paper earlier this month that a host of barriers prevented its members from competing with their local rivals on a level playing field. Wen said that China would improve its legal framework further to create a better environment for foreign businesses. William Burns, U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, says that Russia is closer than ever to its long-running goal of joining the World Trade Organization after more than 17 years of talks. The comment from Burns, the State Department's third-ranking official and its top career diplomat, is the strongest signal yet that Russia and the United States are close to a deal. Russian officials say talks on WTO are continuing, but that they are still waiting for the U.S. to repeal the Jackson-Vanik Amendment, a Cold War-era provision that tied U.S. trade relations to immigration rights for religious minorities. Australia, the world's fourth-largest wheat exporter, is on track for its largest harvest of the grain since 2005-2006. The Australian crop forecasters raised its estimate of the 2010-11 crop by 5% to 23.4 million tons from an August 14th estimate of 22.3 million. Harvesting starts next month. The president and CEO of the Renewable Fuels Association says that time is running out for Congress to extend the 45-cent per gallon ethanol blender's credit. RFA's Bob Dineen says, quote, "Hopefully, in the last 12 days of the congressional session, we'll get some kind of extension. I don't think we'll get a 5-year extension or even a 3-year extension. We just want an extension so that a discussion can begin about tax policy about biofuels." Meanwhile, a group of 8 ethanol and other renewable energy groups have asked U.S. Department of Energy Secretary Stephen Chu to restore $1.5 billion in funding to the DOE's Renewable Energy Loan Guarantee Program. In a letter, the groups say that lawmakers have been borrowing billions of dollars from the fund because of program delays in making payments. The letter says, quote, "Lawmakers have taken $1.5 billion from the loan guarantee program to pay for emergency shortfalls in state revenues. This action follows last year's removal of $2 billion from the LGP to pay for the Cash for Clunkers program, which has not been restored." And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. That's public radio for the farming world. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Don't forget to visit our website. The address is willag.org. That's willag.org. Now, up next, you know this fall corn farmers around the nation will bring in its biggest crop ever. That usually means low prices, but won't be the case this season. I'll have the reasons why from the United States Department of Agriculture and our own ag economist, Darrell Good, from the U of I. The corn crop being harvested right now in the U.S. should be the biggest on record at 13.16 billion bushels. It'll be worth more than any other crop, too. USDA says the average cash price paid to farmers for the 2010 corn crop will range from $4 a bushel to $4.80 a bushel. The midpoint on that range, of $4.40, is 50 cents higher than first predicted in August by the agency, says University of Illinois ag economist Darrell Good, and it's the highest ever on record.
That's pretty impressive. That would be a record high corn price with the largest crop we've ever harvested. So I think it continues to speak to the strong demand that we have for corn domestically and in the world. When we can increase production, we consume more than we produce, and we see higher prices. That's just classic strong demand market.
Demand driven by increasing use for ethanol production and the overseas export market, but not by domestic livestock production.
Basically, on both old crop and new crop, USDA raised their export number on corn. I think both were expected because we have the weekly numbers and the census numbers on the old crop. We knew we were running a little bit ahead of USDA's projection, but not much, 5 million bushels. Jumped new crop exports, 50 million. Old crop ethanol use raised 35 million bushels. The biggest change was a 100 million bushel cut in feed and residual use for next year. So USDA, I think, must be implying that the higher prices may cut into feed demand just a little bit as we move forward. Certainly probably will not cause any liquidation of livestock numbers, but will probably prolong any expansion in livestock numbers.
Historically, Good says corn usage by the domestic livestock base is the very first item to contract when the price of corn is high. And more likely than not, it is the place where the numbers will continue to go down as the prices go up.
Clearly, that's the case. When we've seen periods of extremely high prices or short supplies in the past, for the most part, the adjustment is made in the domestic livestock industry. Right now, domestic use for ethanol is pretty locked in because of mandates and tax credits. If those are extended beyond December 31st, we'll keep that demand strong over very high prices. Similar with exports, we think exports are sensitive to prices and exchange rates, but they're really not. Importers tend to buy what they need They certainly adjust the timing of when they buy based on price expectations, but they have to meet domestic consumption needs, and they will do that over a very wide price range. So the adjustment tends to get forced back to the domestic livestock industry.
USDA dropped the number of bushels of corn used for feed in the September reports by 100 million. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason. You're listening to the Monday edition of the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Greg Johnson is on the phone line from the Andersons to help us take a look at the agricultural cash grain markets this afternoon. Good afternoon to you, Greg. Are you busy there?
We're steady today. I wouldn't say we're getting overrun, but it's steady. We're starting to see that transition from corn to beans. The beans feel like they're going to start being ready midweek, and so some people are getting done with the corn for the time being and switching over to beans. So it's kind of a nice little mix today.
Yields improving for corn as we move through the season?
Yes. Only because they couldn't get any worse, I don't think. there were some pretty disappointing yields in that 120 to 140 bushel range early, and hopefully we're through with those. We're starting to, get up in the 160 to 170 range, but still a far cry from last year's 200.
Yeah, that's way off and a little bit below average, I would think, for this area even.
Yes, and especially considering that USDA was using a record number for the state of Illinois. I know southern Illinois will come in better than a year ago, but I don't think central Illinois will, and I guess the jury's still out on northern Illinois, but we will see. But it sure feels like the number has to come down a little bit more even yet.
Yeah, for those outside of the immediate listening area, there are five or six counties, and those that know that you draw from a pretty big range, you're not talking about Champaign County. You're talking about a much broader area that you draw from, aren't
correct,
you?
Correct. We track an 11-county region around here, and it's pretty consistent in that 11-county region that all those yields are down. Some to the west or even, those are where the dramatically lower yields are. I think there was so much rain early that there was much more flooding and much more nitrogen loss in the counties to the west.
I saw a headline. I talked about this earlier, sell corn or store corn, sell beans. But it doesn't look like there's that much carry in the marketplace at this point.
There's good carry in the corn market. The beans, not as much. The difference in the board price isn't that much, but when you take into account basis, I mean, you're looking at 35 to 40 under the December for cash corn, and then you're only looking for 15 to 20 under the March. So when you get that extra 12 or 13 cents in the futures, plus an extra 20 to 25 cents in the basis improvement, those bins will return probably 30 to 35 cents if you can hold on to it into Jan, Feb, and March.
Give me your bids then.
Cash corn tonight, 445 for fall, 468 for December, 477 for January. The beans are 10.04 right out of the field, 10.29 December, and 10.34 January.
Thanks much.
Thank you, Todd.
I'm back in 2 minutes with the Ag Weather.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's National Peanut Day. Peanuts originated in South America, probably Brazil and Peru. Records show that in the 1800s, peanuts were grown commercially in South Carolina. The first notable increase in U.S. peanut consumption came during the Civil War. Soldiers on both sides turned to peanuts for food. In this day in agricultural history in 1755, Oliver Evans was born. An American millwright, he invented the first automatic corn mill. The mill used bucket elevators and horizontal screw conveyors to move the grain and a hopper boy to cool and dry the meal. In 1833, Calcutta, India, received its very first shipment of imported ice from Boston in a special insulated hold of the clipper Tuscany. About 80 tons was lost through melting. 124 tons made it to port. At first, ice sales were disappointing. Calcutta residents did not know what to make of this novel method for cooling drinks. In 1851, Walter Reed was born. A U.S. Army pathologist, he led the experiments that proved that yellow fever is transmitted by the bite of the mosquito. Until then, it was believed that yellow fever was transmitted through clothing and bedding soiled by body fluids from yellow fever sufferers. And in 1857, Milton Hershey was born. Hershey, an American manufacturer, founded the Hershey's Chocolate Corporation. Among his innovations, using fresh milk in the production of caramels and building of what was then the world's largest chocolate manufacturing plant. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from the University of Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason in with the look at the weather markets for the weather markets, the weather forecast for the afternoon. I guess we could bid on that, John Davis. But although, you know what? They bet on it all the time. So,
it's all in the realm of forecasting, Todd.
Yes, it is. John Davis of Chesapeake Energy in Chicago is with us. And if I was going to bet, I bet it's going to be a beautiful day, evening, and really nice most of the week. What do you say?
It is, and especially here across the Eastern Belt, we have a relatively dry week, relatively warm temperatures for this time of year. So as fieldwork operations kind of begin in earnest across many areas of the Midwest, the Eastern Midwest will be in real good shape and have a good week of weather. If we turn our attentions to the Western Midwest, places like Iowa and Minnesota, it's going to be a bit wetter out across there. Region is they do get a couple of systems kind of bogging down across that region. So that's the portion of the Midwest that will have some delays in fieldwork operations this week.
And they'll delay their fieldwork operation, but they're farther behind than we are. They're probably on time. We're just ahead here in our part of the world. We're not going to get rainfall. I think that probably if you look out a little further, the folks in Indiana, the southern part of that state and on into Ohio would really like some rain. Are they going to get an opportunity at any point?
It doesn't appear so, no. You know, they had a very good opportunity last week when the remnants of Tropical Storm Hermine moved up into the plains. But as that moisture moved from Missouri and Arkansas toward the Ohio Valley, that system basically died out. So, yes, they did have a good opportunity last week in some of those areas of the Ohio Valley, but they pretty much missed that opportunity. And now over the next week or 10 days, opportunities are few and far between. So really no major improvement there.
Yeah, when things get dry, they tend to stay dry.
Absolutely.
And it appears that'll be the case.
And then the thing that changes things at this time of year is the remnants of tropical activity. That's how you can get big rains at this time of year.
Okay, so now take me out west and talk about the Great Plains states, hard red winter wheat growing regions, and how they're setting up for the sowing season.
Again, huge variability across that region. Some real dry spots across areas still of some pockets of Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas. The northern areas are much wetter, Nebraska, places like that. And this week is going to feature more of the same. Active conditions up north in Nebraska and South Dakota, and relatively dry conditions in Kansas, Oklahoma, and northern Texas.
Better take me south into the southern hemisphere and talk about Brazil and Argentina as they set up for their growing season.
In Brazil, we are getting concerned about dryness across those areas as seeding continues and is just now starting in the central and northern areas, and we expect dry weather for the next couple of weeks, the next item to watch.
Anything else to add before I let you go for the day?
That's good.
Okay, thanks much.
All right, Todd.
That's John Davis. He's with Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois, up on the 23rd floor of the Boeing building there, looking out the Chicago skyline. Stay with us if you can for the Farming World this afternoon. We'll talk with the folks at the American Farm Bureau Federation. This is a rerun, so Just keep that in mind as you listen to Mary Kay Thatcher. I'm Todd Gleason. You have a great afternoon. This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we'll talk with Mary Kay Thatcher. She's the Director of Public Policy at American Farm Bureau Federation and located in Washington, D.C. Ms. Thatcher, thank you so much for being on the program. Farm Bill is, well, beginning to heat up despite the fact that it will be 2012 when Congress really probably gets around to trying to put it into place. What are the primary policy functions at AFBF, the American Farm Bureau Federation, that you're following at this point?
Well, certainly the budget is going to dictate largely our next farm bill, and that's why Colin Peterson has thought maybe it's good to start early. I think whether you believe you're going to have a Democratic-controlled House and Senate when you come back after November, or if the House might flip, that regardless, you're going to have people who are interested in this budget deficit finally. And if that's the case, you're probably going to have a budget reconciliation bill early in 2011 where they would come to the committees and say, cut 5% of your budget or 8%, 10%, who knows what the right percentage is. But certainly agriculture won't be exempt from them. So we probably will have to start in 2011 because going in and trying to cut that much money out of the budget in 2011 and thinking you're not going to have to reopen the farm bill to do it is crazy. And the worst thing would be to rewrite it once in 2011 and rewrite it once in 2012. But depending on how much money we have is going to say a lot about what kind of farm policy we can afford in the future.
Can you divide up the farm policy for me? Because this farm bill takes up so much more than just that's related directly to the land. And maybe, I don't know whether you have the percentages, but give me an idea of where the budget splits out on all the types of things that operate USDA.
Well, we are now exceeding 70% of the USDA budget that is spent for nutrition programs. That's food stamps, women, infant, and children, school breakfast, school lunch, those types of programs, 70 cents out of every dollar. Then you've got the rest of the programs, be it farm programs, crop insurance, conservation, research, energy, credit, that take up the other 30%. So when you really look at the farm bill and the large pots of money, you obviously don't have a bunch of money in the loan rate target price category because with prices, it doesn't look like we're going to trigger those for a few years. So if you're looking for big pots of money in which to fundamentally change current farm policy, you have to look at the direct payments or at crop insurance or at conservation. And much of conservation is kind of tough to look at because, you know, off the cuff, I'm going to tell you probably more than half of the budget is for the Conservation Reserve Program. And we and everyone else have argued long and hard that once you have a 10-year contract with farmers for CRP, you don't break that contract. So those are the three pots of money that people will be looking at if they indeed wanted to fundamentally change the farm bill.
Well, it seems that the administration is, while they said they weren't really going to do much with the farm bill, at least at one point last week or the week and a half ago, they turned around and already have started to discuss revamping the farm bill in unique and different ways and looking at the revenue assurance programs and the insurance programs and finding different ways to fund them. What do you think of that, and what does AFBF have to say about it?
I think they'll be very involved. They said they weren't going to submit a bill on their own, but certainly they would submit ideas and concepts, and I'm sure they will do background information on how is the ACRE program working and how is the SURE program, the disaster program, working and what could we do to further enhance crop insurance. I'm sure they will have many ideas, but what I think is very clear is that this administration will focus largely on rural development issues. If you listen to Tom Vilsack, either before the House Ag Committee a couple of weeks ago or in all the speeches he gives around the country, he is big on let's look at rural communities and what we can do there, and not real big on let's look at production agriculture. So that will be something. But again, you know, whether it's this administration or any other administration, they can make all the recommendations they want to the Hill, but it's the Senate and House Ag Committees that actually draft the bill. So it's sort of like the budget that comes up every year. You may not like what this administration or some other administration has sent, but for all intents and purposes, it's somewhat dead on arrival, and it's the Hill that actually writes the bill.
Well, let's take up some individual things that our farm listeners will be very interested in. AFBF have a position on direct payments?
Well, right now, our position is that we largely like the farm bill that's in place. We think it's working pretty darn well. And I think the question's going to come in on some people believe, and certainly this is true, direct payments are sometimes hard to justify, hard to keep, because people say, why would you pay farmers to not plant or to plant some other crop, et cetera? I think what they fail to take into account is that, you know, we did that somewhat with the direct payments years ago to be able to give farmers flexibility to plant what they wanted to plant versus have to look at the rates from the government. And we also did it because it's very, very compliant with World Trade Organization negotiations. And while the Doha negotiation is dead as a doornail right now, the fact is it will be back. And at some point, we'll have to make cuts in those trade-distorting programs, the things that we classify as amber and blue box. Well, direct payments are green box, and they won't have to be cut to meet international obligations for a long time. So there are people out there who don't like direct payments who are working diligently to try to get rid of them, and they haven't really decided. Do you go to an acre-type program? Do you go to an expanded crop insurance program? What do you really do with it? We've got our state farm bureaus talking about that in a big way, trying to figure out where they want to go. But as of today, our policy says that we think the current farm bill is working pretty well.
You mentioned acre. Take that up. Do you think that that's looks like it's going to work well for producers who have enrolled in it? And they're, I don't remember the exact number, but I think it was about 13% to 15% in the Midwest or the Corn Belt that enrolled in that program.
Right. Not a real high percentage of folks that went in. I suspect that after they saw it work for a year, we'll have a little greater participation this year. Certainly, if you got into it as a wheat producer, you did fairly well. Corn and soybeans probably would have done pretty well this year, too. Doesn't really work for cotton and rice. I think the question with acre is, unless the participation rate really jumps, that people either say, it's not worth it, let's get rid of it, or they'll say, let's expand it. And instead of going from a trigger where it gets triggered at a statewide level, maybe we can trigger it at a countywide level or a regional level to make it closer to home. So I suspect it won't live as is, but it could be amended if people decide they want to put additional funding into it.
Universities or land grants have been big supporters of the program, thinking that it works fairly well to help farmers out in their in leveling their revenue when they need it. I was a bit surprised, I guess, personally, that last week, I think it was the Iowa Farm Bureau that came out and said, this is not a program we like or want.
Well, and that's what they're for their discussion for the next time. I think, you know, you have to figure out, do you want to be covered at kind of a whole farm level, or is it important to you, for example, with crop insurance, to be able to insure just your corn acres or just your bean acres? And the same kinds of arguments are going to occur in the crop insurance program in the next farm bill. People are going to say, can we afford to go to a whole farm revenue program? And you'll find many people on the Hill that'll say, you know, we should just be out there for producers for real disasters. And, okay, so if you suffer a winter wheat total loss, but you have bumper crops and soybeans, then should we really be coming in with government help? And there's certainly many, many ways to look at that. But those are the kinds of, you know, 20,000-foot philosophical discussions that will obviously go on between now and whenever we finish this next farm bill.
All right, next topic. Let's take up some of the other things that might be of interest to WTO and the farm bill. For instance, Brazil continues to win cases against cotton in the WTO. That's one that the WTO, the World Trade Organization, says does not fit. Can you explain how that works or why it is the case and what implications that might have as the farm bill debate ensues in the coming months?
Well, the Brazilian took a case against us in the WTO saying that our cotton subsidies exceeded what we were allowed under current negotiations. And through a couple of years of deliberations now, they did indeed finally win, and they agreed that they understood that this wasn't something the administration could overturn and could fix to make us in compliance, and that it was going to have to wait till the next farm bill. And so until then, we're paying the Brazilians about $150 million a year, presumably through 2012. But, you know, the difficult thing is that the Brazilians, in essence, will have a seat at the table when we're writing the next farm bill, because they found us to be out of compliance, or they went to the WTO and they found us. So there will have to be some changes, both in the cotton program and probably the GSM 102. It's an export credit type program, in order to bring us back into compliance in the next farm bill.
Now, is $150 million enough of an incentive to make the Senate and the House set up and pay attention to it?
Well, yes, because really this, quote, deal between the Brazilians and the U.S. was only cut until that point in time because they understood, you know, they had to wait. But beyond that, they would come back. If we didn't fulfill what we said we would do in these negotiations, they'll come back and take us to the WTO again, and we'll have another litigation on our docket. So we've got to be able to do something. And the other thing is they have the ability to come back and retaliate against us. And what they do is they don't retaliate just against cotton. They retaliate against other agricultural products. They retaliate against small business. They took on some of our intellectual property rights. So there is plenty of effort and plenty of kind of spreading the pain across the U.S., I think, probably for them to make their point.
So a foregone conclusion, you think, at this point that those programs will be changed or eliminated then?
Well, I don't think they'll be eliminated. You know, it's a little questionable yet what you do to the GSM 102 program to make it completely legal. But I think without a doubt, you're going to have to at least reduce both of the programs, the benefits of both of those programs.
What does GSM 102 do?
It provides export credits so that if we're competing with some other country to send an export to China or somewhere in Asia, anywhere, we can provide a little bit of credit to make our product more competitive with another country's. And other countries also use those. Mostly, to tell you the truth, export credits are used by the Europeans and by the U.S. But it's an order to help us be more competitive.
Is it a line of credit that the country gets to use, or is it actually money that gets put into the
It's actually a low-interest type of a loan.
All right. Next topic. Let's move on to animal ID. National animal ID has been a big topic and remains a big topic. It's controversial, depending on which side of the fence I suppose you stand on. Tell me about the program itself, what it's supposed to do, and then maybe some of the controversy that surrounds it, please.
Well, the thought was that animal ID would allow us to trace back animal health issues in a very timely manner. If you got foot and mouth disease or you got swine flu or some of those things, that it would be a quicker trace back and that we wouldn't have to do as much really looking for these animals. And, you know, this is really a sort of a sector by sector initiative because if you look at the swine industry, if you look at the sheep industry, the dairy industry, those folks already have those animals. Well, the poultry industry and the swine industry, they don't really have to tag each animal individually. They just have to keep them in lots and move them by lots. And, you know, maybe there's one tag for 100 hogs. So it's not hard to do. They're already in a barn. It's not expensive, et cetera. The problem comes in when you go to beef cattle because we raise beef cattle oftentimes out in pastures. You get out in the West, you may not see that cow for several months. And to individually tag each animal, the cost is about $6 a tag. It runs up and is pretty expensive pretty quickly. So I think that finally what this administration has come to is to say, you know, we're not doing very well in moving this animal ID process along. Let's stop where we are. Let's not have us make any more progress at the federal level. And let's turn it over to the states and say, as long as animals just move intra within the state, you can regulate those animals. You can decide what to do. Once they move interstate, they go across state lines, then they're going to have an animal ID. But states ought to figure it out. Well, you know, we think it's great that they understand that what they had wasn't working. I think it's going to be very difficult to make this kind of an approach work, too, because you know, theoretically, you could have states just say, I don't want to play. Well, what are you going to do about that from the federal level?
You're listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. This afternoon, we're talking with Mary Kay Thatcher. She's the Director of Public Policy at American Farm Bureau Federation in Washington, D.C. More in a moment.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, the International Monetary Fund today reaffirmed its call to extend fiscal stimulus and boost job growth. In a paper, the IMF argued that labor markets are in a dire state, with more and more workers unable to find jobs for longer periods. The IMF says that up to a point, fiscal stimulus is worth the additional debt if it helps cut long-term unemployment. The IMF also called for an extension in unemployment benefits to help maintain consumer demand and worker morale. Pork producer Smithfield Foods says it will sell its 49% stake in turkey producer Butterball LLC to its joint venture partner for about $175 million. Smithfield and Maxwell Farms LLC have jointly owned the Butterball brand since 2006. The sale should be completed by the end of the year, and Smithfield will use the proceeds to pay down debt. Maxwell Farms will then sell half of Butterball to agriculture company Seaboard Corporation. Next week, the Federal Communications Commission will consider new rules that could mean a new flavor of Wi-Fi with longer range and wall-piercing power, and that could show up in wireless gadgets a year from now. Nearly 2 years ago, the FCC voted to open up the airwaves between broadcast TV channels, so-called white spaces. The commission's plan would make white spaces available for free without specific permission, just as it has already done for Wi-Fi and Bluetooth. And that's a look at today's business news.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. This afternoon, we're talking with Mary Kay Thatcher. She's the Director of Public Policy at the American Farm Bureau Federation. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We had just moved to the topic of animal ID when we last spoke with Ms. Thatcher. And maybe we should make a transition at this point, Ms. Thatcher, to animal welfare. The Humane Society of the United States has been a bane in the animal livestock side of the world for the last couple of years. And I say bane because I think that's a name that the animal livestock side would certainly use with them. Tell me about what's been happening with this group, where they came from, and what the problems they have with the livestock side might be, and how livestock views them.
Certainly, HSUS has made a real upcoming in the world in the last 5 or 6 years. And I think what they recognized is that they had tried for a good long time to pass federal legislation that would affect animal welfare issues, for the most part, not very successfully. And so several years ago, they sort of changed their idea and they said, you know what, why don't we go out to ballot states around the country in about half of our states and do have ballot initiatives that are available to them. And let's go, and we think we'll have more luck convincing voters on a ballot than we will state legislators or certainly federal legislators. And so they've done that fairly successfully in several states. They've been able to go to other states and threaten, hey, you know what, we're coming to your state. We intend to spend $3 or $4 or $5 million to defeat you in a ballot initiative. So instead, why don't you join forces with us and do this via legislation, and we'll save ourselves all time and money and effort, et cetera. We anticipate this will continue to happen. They have worked on things all the way from puppy mill type legislation that they're at in Missouri this year to, of course, banning gestation crates and battery cages and veal tethering, et cetera. So we suspect that this state-by-state initiative will continue until the time that they think they have enough states out there where they can come back to the federal government and make the argument, okay, we got 20 states or 30 states out there with varying degrees of legislation. Now we need to make all those legislation. We need to make it uniform here at the federal level. So we know eventually it'll come back here. For the most part, have we dealt with horse slaughter and federal procurement of meats? Yes, but more of their initiative has been at the state level versus the federal level.
Yeah, so they're working diligently, and I suppose it's an organization that it appears that you have to kind of come to the table with at some point because they're working through the legislative process.
Well, they are, and what they do is they threaten states. They say things like, you know what, we're going to come, we're going to spend $4 million in your state, and if you will help us in legislation, we'll give you 10 years to phase out gestation crates. If you don't and you beat us in legislation, then next year we'll take it to a ballot initiative, and we're only going to give you 3 years to phase it out. So they make producers pretty nervous who know they don't have the amount of money to be able to phase out their current production system in 3 years, and they think, well, maybe negotiating is better than anything else. They also are, unfortunately, kind of good at splitting off industries. You know, they'll get the poultry industry to pull out of an agricultural coalition or the pork industry, et cetera. And once you start, you know, splintering in those agricultural industry groups, then they have you. So they are able to do that. They have a tremendous amount of money. They're quite the money-raising machine. In reality, what they really do is to make people believe that they represent the local dog and cat shelters, when indeed they do not.
Right.
Less than one-half of 1% of their funding actually goes to helping hands-on animal welfare-type issues. Most of it goes into legislative battles and legal battles, et cetera.
Well, I guess in the bottom line, then, it's just the democratic process in order. Whether you like it or don't like it doesn't matter. It's the way it happens, isn't it?
It is. It's a huge threat, though, and it's something I think we're starting to get a handle on. I mean, we're feeling kind of good. You looked at Yellowtail Wine that was going to give a bunch of money to HSUS, and when we went to them and said, do you know what you're doing here? If you want to give money for animal welfare purposes, there are better ways to do it. We had a truck stop that was going to, you know, serve only meat products that were humanely raised. We were able to turn that around. But they have enough money and enough staff. Their staff is about 550 people strong around the country. So lots of people that work only on animal welfare issues. And they have a budget of about $130 million a year. So it's something that we're going to continue to have to work at. But I think we got farmers out there. They're doing YouTube videos. They're speaking at Rotary clubs. They're talking to folks at church. They're getting out the story that HSUS is really another PETA and not something that we should be very trusting of.
Final topic, budget. It's a tight one. We started talking about it, I suppose, up front just a bit when we began this conversation with the farm bill. What things are at risk, do you think, under the budget process?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I think you got to believe virtually everything other than maybe Department of Homeland Security and Department of Defense would be at risk for budget cuts. It is so out of line that, you know, you just can't tinker around the edges and expect to make any progress. We're now at, you know, somewhere in the range of about 13-14% of our GDP is tied up in deficit. We got Social Security growing and Medicare and Medicaid. And you know, really, there's probably only about 40% of the budget that you can really do something about. So if you, when you're talking about making cuts, unless you're willing to make those tough decisions on things like Social Security and Medicare, it makes it much more difficult. But I think probably you get people looking at Greece right now saying, you know what happened in Greece could happen here. They let things get out of whack, too much running on autopilot over there. And we need to wake up here and make sure that we're doing something about that deficit. So I think people are already waking up to that. It won't happen this year because it's an election year, and it's going to be a very difficult election year in the country. But I strongly suspect that we will have to do something pretty draconian about the budget come 2011.
Mary Kay Thatcher is the Director of Public Policy at the American Farm Bureau Federation. She's been here with us on the Land Grants, the Farming World. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.